It is nearly the winter solstice here in the south. It's due in about a week on the 22nd of June. So we are almost at the turn of winter into milder weather. But first, winter will do its best to be the perfection of what it is. There are three main ideas today about perfection. And because I've worked so hard at this topic in a sort of scholarly way, I must admit that I'm ready to be corrected by any one of you where you see there's a logical flaw. So please don't take my word for it. I think you might know best. Right, so there are three main ideas about perfection. The first is the idea that God is perfect and that the prophets of the different religions encourage us to strive for perfection while acknowledging that we are human and cannot reach perfection. The gap between ourselves and God is used to motivate us to work, to draw closer. And this message is contained in most of the religions represented here on the altar, especially Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and Buddhism. The second idea is that perfection is a state of spiritual awareness or unity with the divine, which we may experience despite being imperfect ourselves. This idea is presented in the older religions like Hinduism. And the third idea is that we actually are perfect because God is in us. When we are God conscious, we can experience being part of God at any moment. This is a mystical idea which rests upon God consciousness as a cultivated field of awareness. Sufism represents this idea, whilst also acknowledging the other two. How did this question arise for me? First, the idea of perfection fell into my hands when I opened a book about Buddhism and read again about the perfections. These are spiritual ideals encouraged by the Mahayana school of Buddhism for anyone on the path of enlightenment. We're encouraged to cultivate these ideals or perfections in order to be more ready to connect with God. And now the Buddhist description or mapping of perfection has a list of ideals, which are generosity, morality, patience, vigor, advanced meditation, and understanding. And then there are further four perfections added, which are skill in means, which does not necessarily mean skill with one's money and cattle, but mainly one's inner resources like compassion and loving kindness. The others are conviction, strength, and knowledge. The perfections are ideals of spiritual perfection designed to act as guidance on the seeker's path to self-realization. They are firstly ideals for worldly life. Then on a second level, there are ideals for our emotional life. And finally, there are ideals for the spiritual life. This provides a broad and everyday basis in which to make an effort to accomplish perfection. Then we may choose to apply them or sense what needs to be developed more. This Buddhist list is a useful encouragement to strive for perfection in everyday life with a view to accomplishing spiritual perfection. Here I want to refer to the idea of Zen, which is also a Buddhist idea. And this is actually the thing that got me going when I read this list of Buddhist perfections. Because I wasn't interested so much in all the striving. I was very interested in the aha moment. And the idea of serendipity. What is an instant of perfection? When we get that sense or vision of harmony in our lives, that the world is working to express an ideal through the streams of love, harmony, and beauty, we may experience the joy of events and feelings harmonizing in an instant of perfection. And now I want to read to you a story illustrating how an ideal may inspire us in our actions. And it's from this book of stories written by Hidayat Inayat Khan, the youngest son of the founder of the Sufi movement, Hazrat Inayat Khan. Story, the volume is called Once Upon a Time. And this story is called A Jug of Cool Water. And Hidayat is now talking about himself as the son, the child of Inayat Khan. Each day, we children were given a particular subject of concentration, such as, for instance, patience, tolerance, forgiveness, kindness, politeness, nobility, humility. And in the evenings, we came to our father to tell whether or not we had really, truly concentrated on the chosen subject. One day, the subject of concentration was courage. In the evening on that same day, a dinner party had been arranged, on which occasion special guests had been invited. This being, of course, quite a problem for our mother, especially on some very hot days during the summer school, and this is in France. In those days, running water from the tap came out almost as warm as the sun outside. Besides, in those days, there was no such thing as a refrigerator, and consequently, cool drinks could just not possibly be served. As soon as the guests had been seated at the very beautifully decorated dinner table, our father asked, "Who shall go to fetch cool water in the cellar?" Each one present looked at each other, hoping that the other one would do it, but nothing happened. Then, remembering all of a sudden that courage had been the subject of concentration that day, I jumped up and ran right down into the dark cellar, while screaming at the top of my voice in order to cover up my fright of the mice, the spiders, the bugs, and the imaginary phantoms. After a lot of searching, I finally found the magic tap, out of which cool water was flowing from under the ground. And when I came back with the jug of cool water in my trembling hands, my father took it tenderly from me and said, "This shall be a blessing for you during your whole life." Bhajan Guru, Mirabeta, and my father added, "That terrifying experience shall remain in your memory as the happiest remembrance in your life, because at that very moment you have wanted to vanquish your fright with the strength of your willpower for the sake of an ideal, the ideal of courage, which was the subject of concentration today. Yes, indeed, says Idiot. I could really not think on any happier moment than the great joy experienced in having had the privilege of being able to have done just only that much for my beloved father. And this is a father who was so consciously involved in inspiring and attending to his child, even while hosting a full table of dinner guests. Now let's look at how the Hindu tradition regards perfection. In Hinduism, success is not achieved by itself, but as a consequence of a transformative spiritual effort that leads to perfection, in equanimity and sameness, which they call samasid, towards the dualities of life. So in other words, it's a kind of equanimity in facing the contradictions of life. In many instances, success and perfection are used synonymously, since there is a deep connection between them. And this is strange to hear the word success, which we identify with our modern culture, as coming from Hinduism. Indeed, in Sanskrit, the same word, sid, denotes both success and perfection. In the state of perfection, you are both successful and perfect. The state of perfection is also the state of completeness. Hence, when you are perfect, there is nothing you need to do to achieve anything or complement yourself. The state of absolute perfection is also the state of the self and God. Both are holy and absolutely complete and perfect. It is incorrect to think that the worlds, beings, or any of the creations of God are imperfect. Their imperfections, if any, may be intended as an appearance to fill a place or a function in the order of things. They may be impure, ridden with the negative influences and the modifications of nature, but they are not imperfect. Perfection is inherent in God's creation. Neither perfection nor imperfection can arise from nothing, since there must be a cause for everything. If the Creator is a perfect being, and his skills and actions are excellently skillful, his creation must be excellently perfect. It cannot be otherwise, because imperfection cannot arise from what is eternally, completely, and absolutely perfect and complete. This perfection is not in a reality or state that you have to create in order to experience it. It's already there in your very essence. You either enter it or let it show itself by removing the obstacles and the impurities that are active in you because of Maya. Thus, attaining perfection is a process of self-discovery, or a process of self-discovery, or finding truth, rather than an accomplishment in the worldly sense. You reach it through a self-transformative process by removing the imperfections and the impurities that are present in you as tendencies, qualities, traits, desires, attachments, and impulses. So by reflecting on the Hindu ideal of perfection, we add the words success and truth to the description. If we consider Zoroastrianism, the message there is that just as God is perfect, He wants us to strive towards perfection, even in the world. Perfection has its own goodness, holiness, and power. It is good for the world and can make the world perfect. Though we human beings cannot be perfect, we must keep working towards achieving perfection all the time. The Zoroastrian ideal is purity. The body is regarded as the residence of the soul. The soul is God's radiance. To keep God's radiance sacred, it is necessary for the seeker to preserve the body's health. To do this, one must keep a boundary from the outside, impure environment, impure air, impure aura, or impure events. Our place of reciting prayer should be a clean place, made sacred. So the descriptive words we're adding here to the description of perfection are power, radiance, purity, health, cleanliness, and sacredness. And here I want to mention the African tradition, which we didn't include in our readings today. Traditional African religion conceives of God as an omnipotent, omniscient, and omnibenevolent creator. And according to this view, God is a perfect being who can do all logically possible things. He creates the world and gives free will to all human beings. So it's strange to think of such a kind of formal thing as perfection actually arriving from the free will of human beings. In the Judaic ideal of perfection, the concept of perfection is not the same as the mathematically based Greek view. It actually means blameless or complete. And the word in Judaic scripture is often used to describe an animal used in sacrifice as being without a blemish. But to be perfect, the standard of perfection is actually a moral one, not an intellectual one. So I might get every answer on the math test wrong, and God would still count me as perfect, as long as I'm in alignment with His will and instructions. Conversely, I could be the most correct person on earth and still be hopelessly imperfect in God's eyes because I reject or disobey the Torah. And living according to Torah is the epitome of shalom, peace with God, and peacefulness among the people on earth. And this also implies soundness, full health, completely truthful, and what is ethically upright and unspoilt, undefiled. And these ideas are found in activities, our human activities. What is upright for God should meet His standards in behavior and thought. And what is pure meets His standards in ritual. The study of the Torah is one of the three most important disciplines of Judaism. And of course, it is focused on the restoration of the soul. So here in the Judaic description of perfection, we have the words integrity, activity, speech, and the restoration of the soul. In the Christian tradition, the Christian texts typically define perfection as spiritual maturity, completeness, and wholeness. And the ultimate goal is to grow to be similar to Christ through grace, rather than striving under the pressure of worldly perfection. So the ideal is not to meet worldly standards, but inner spiritual standards, which is similar to the Buddhist idea. And Christian writers often distinguish between perfection and perfectionism. And while perfectionism focuses on flawless behavior and often leads to our anxiety, the biblical idea of perfection rests on spiritual growth and love. So there we've added the word love and grace. Then in Islam, the scriptures command Muslims to practice ihsan. And this is defined as spiritual excellence, the highest level of faith where one acts as if they see God, knowing that even if they cannot see Him, He sees them. In Islam, only Allah is perfect. God is perfect. And rather than demanding flawless, sinless behavior from humans, the faith emphasizes ihsan, excellence, and sincerity. And human fallibility is accepted as part of the creation story, making sincere effort and constant repentance central to spiritual growth. A pre-Islamic poet said, "The one who does not respect or honor himself can never be respected or honored." And Islam reminds us that God is the most merciful, the most compassionate, which also encourages us to go easy on ourselves. So the word compassion there is part of perfection. And now I come to the Sufi path to perfection, and I'd like to read another thing to you. And this is volume 10 of the Sufi message, which is called Sufi Mysticism. And This is something Inayat Khan wrote about Rumi. He's describing how Rumi became a mystic by following Shamsi Tabriz. And what Shams said is that all things which seem of importance, what are they on the day you depart? What is rank? What is power? What is position? A far greater problem is what will go with you for the solution of that problem, will heal, will lead you to eternity. The problems of this world, you may solve them and solve them, yet they are never finished. What have you understood about God, about man? What relationship have you found between man and God? If you worship God, why do you worship him? What is limitation? What is perfection? And how can one seek for it? And Rumi was very much affected by this statement and began to follow him, began to follow this person he regarded as his spiritual teacher, Shamsi Tabriz. And Rumi wandered from place to place with him until one day Shamsi Tabriz left him. And Rumi experienced a wonderful upliftment as he began to recall what his spiritual teacher had taught him. He experienced a great joy and exaltation. And in order to make this exaltation complete, Rumi began to write poetry. And Hazrat Inayat Khan says, man today has become so material, and he was writing this in the early 1900s, and I think our life now has more of a focus on meaning and spirit, but still, let's hear what he says. He says, man is afraid of any experience except that of the senses. He believes that only what he can experience through the senses is real experience, and that which is not experienced by the senses is something unbalanced, something to be afraid of. It means going into deep waters, something abnormal, at the least an untrodden path. Very often man is afraid that he might fall into a trance, or have a feeling which is unusual, and thinks that those who experience such things are fanatics who have gone out of their minds. And this is actually the point at which Rumi experienced illumination and exaltation, this point at which he was regarded by others as having gone out of his mind. But it is not so. Thought belongs to the mind and feeling to the heart. Why should one believe that thought is right and feeling is wrong? A life of sensation lacks the experience of exaltation. Even religious prayers, rituals, and ceremonies were intended to produce exaltation, for it is one of the needs of life. Exaltation is as necessary, or perhaps even more so, as the cultivation of thought. And the words that we've heard in that description, the words that began the seed for this talk were the words, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, which were the words said with the lighting of the first candle this morning. And if we consider all the words about the nature of perfection, perhaps all that is left is to listen to some music. Thank you. We're going to listen to some music.